Support for IPR comes from Mearden, Supel & Downer, attorneys at law, dedicated to providing comprehensive legal solutions for Eastern Iowa since 1948. Located in downtown Iowa City and at MeardenLaw.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, the U.S. Department of Energy has selected an ISU-led project to build rural Iowa's first microgrid, and that will happen in the town of Montezuma, east of Des Moines. Later in the hour, my conversation with a couple of people involved in that project. But first, the buildup of nitrate in farm fields, a likely result of the drought, has set the stage for a potentially massive uptick in stream pollution this spring. That's according to my next guest, Chris Jones, a former University of Iowa researcher who studies agriculture's effects on water quality. He was with us last June of 2023, when his book came out, The Swine Republic, Struggles with the Truth About Agriculture and Water Quality. Chris Jones, welcome back to our studio.
Okay, thanks, Ben. Good to be back.
All right. Listeners, join us with your questions about Iowa's water quality. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. How is the stage set for a potentially big increase in stream pollution this spring, Chris?
Well, we've seen throughout recent history that stream conditions in a post-drought time frame, that's when we see our highest stream nitrate levels. And so we saw that especially in 2013. We had a drought here the second half of 2011 and then pretty much all of 2012. And in 2013, we saw the highest nitrate levels in our streams we've ever seen. And I think the Raccoon River over in Polk County was about 25 milligrams per liter of nitrate, more than double the drinking water standard. We saw similar things happen in the early 90s following the drought of 1988 and 1989, and then also going back to the 70s. We had quite a drought here in Iowa, 1976, 1977, and then in the years immediately after that, very high nitrate levels in our streams.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what would it take to trigger that? These nitrates are, we assume, in the soil because of the drought. They didn't get washed away. They didn't get used by plants. Is that what you're saying here?
So, I mean, let's ask ourselves why there's this buildup of nitrogen in the soils. And it's because we over-apply nitrogen here in Iowa. And so these past few years, we've had some dry weather, no doubt about it, but crop yields are still pretty good here these past few years. And so, I mean, farmers are pretty open about this. They apply extra nitrogen as insurance, and so during dry weather, that quote-unquote extra doesn't get washed away, which ordinarily would be sort of the baseline level in our streams. And you have a drought that spans several years. That buildup increases year after year after year. Then the rain finally does come back, and, you know, you have incredible nitrate levels.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to play for you a little quote from the Mark Licht, an ISU crop specialist. Last Friday, I had him on this program. I raised the point you just made about the buildup of nitrate in the soil due to the drought and the potential threat of increased pollution. I'd like to have you react to how Mark Licht of ISU characterized it.
Now, it's not like it's a cumulative, you know, going back through this dry period, because we have had, you know, corn and soybeans and crops taking up nitrogen and utilizing it. So it's in some respects every summer, you know, with that crop growth, we reset that, you know. So once we harvest, that's when the nitrate buildup, you know, in the soil starts to build again, and that's just through a natural process that, you know, we're lucky to have, right? We have a lot of organic matter, and organic matter mineralization occurs naturally when we have soils that are not frozen and we have adequate moisture there. You know, so I really do think that Chris is making some good points, but I don't know that it may not be as severe as sometimes we think it might be.
Okay. So Mark Licht moderates what you've just said here, the threat here. He talked about a reset. To what degree do you agree or disagree with what he just said?
Well, I agree that it may not be all that bad if the return to normal precipitation regimes is gradual and sort of gentle. But as we've seen here, you know, over the last 50 years, that's not the way nature works, right? We don't have this gentle return to normal. We tend to have these whiplash sort of events where we go from extreme to extreme, and we're seeing that all over planet Earth, right, with weather. And so I think the hope that we will return to a normal regime sort of gently is, you know, it's risky to assume that, really risky to assume that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the mineralization, you know, agriculture has used this idea of mineralization as a red herring for a long time. And so it's true that nitrogen does sort of cycle through the soil, and depending where you're at in the state, you know, that process can span, you know, weeks, months, years even. And, you know, here's the thing. Yes, the soil does produce nitrogen, but we replace that with our inputs. And so, you know, the idea that soil mineralization is the cause of this problem is just not right.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the consequences here. So a trigger for this big increase in pollution in our waterways would be heavy rains. I mean, we don't know. We had such a weird winter. Some say the lost winter here. We don't know what's ahead of us. We're sort of in uncharted territory, aren't we?
Well, I'd say certainly the weather this past winter was extraordinary. I mean, we had 2 weeks of winter, right? At least where I live in Iowa City, there was 2 weeks of winter. And you know, what would cause this? Well, the main thing would be to get enough precipitation to cause the field tiles to be flowing regularly. And so that's the main contributor. And so much of our state is drained with field tiles. We've lowered the water table 4 feet over much of Iowa, especially areas north of Interstate 80. And once you get a soil condition where there's enough water to keep the tiles flowing all the time, that's when you get high nitrate. And so that's what it would take.
Yeah, so those not acquainted with our underground tiling network in this state, this prevents water from going deeper, and it contributes to the amount of water running off into streams and all the way down the Mississippi to what we've created there, the dead zone, because of our practices here.
Right, and so the water, you know, the tile dries out the soil. And so in Iowa, we know that we have, you know, what we call wet soils and cold soils. And, you know, farmers want to get that dried out early in the season so they can get the corn planted. And the way to do that is drainage tile. And so the tile intercepts water percolating from the surface, and then it also intercepts water coming up from the water table. And so all of that I just described is high nitrate water. That gets discharged to the stream network, and so that's, you know, the primary vehicle for high nitrate.
Over time, whether it's drought or not, doesn't nitrate dissipate?
So if it can encounter an environment where there's no oxygen, then microorganisms will use nitrate as an oxygen source and then convert the nitrogen to nitrogen gas, which off gases to the atmosphere. And so, yes, nitrogen, you know, is sort of it will leave the landscape. That's true after a while. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our callers. If you've just joined us, my guest for this portion of the program, Chris Jones, former University of Iowa researcher, studies still very active in writing about on his Substack, Agriculture's Effects on Water Quality. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Mike in Windsor Heights. Mike, thanks for calling. What's on your mind here?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was doing water quality testing for the Polk County snapshot after that drought that Chris referred to, and the measurements we found all over the county were 20 milligrams per liter and more, which is, you know, really high. I got a lot of pushback when I let people know about that, you know, and they said, well, that was just an aberration. Well, that's true. It was an aberration, but it was real, and it was problematic. Mm. In there's a book by a guy named Frerich called Barons, and he talks a lot about animal confinements and the consequences and the politics and all in his first chapter. So excellent. But he has in here a quote from a farmer that was published in the Des Moines Register about 1993. The farmer said, why are they trying to promote something that will both hurt the environment and sell our young people into lives of indentured servitude? Hmm. I thought, wow. 1993. That was so, you know, like prophetic. But I know I've worked with a lot of people, and I've tried really hard to do something on the policy side, but it's just been impossible.
Okay.
It looks like the marketplace is going to have some impact. But I have a question for Chris. I remember he did some research on nitrogen in snow. Can you comment on that, Chris?
Nitrogen and snow. We're coming up on a break in less than 2 minutes, just to give you a heads up
so,
there, Chris.
Yes, both our rain and our snow does have nitrogen in it. That comes from a couple different sources. One, lightning oxidizes nitrogen gas in the atmosphere. That's dissolved in the raindrops. And then we have it in the snow. We have off-gassing of ammonia and nitrate from our confinements, and the snowfall scrubs that out of the atmosphere. And so as precipitation falls on the landscape, it does contribute to the inputs of nitrogen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the lack of snow, well, there are 2 weeks of winter. How does that impact it?
Well, I mean, this precipitation is a significant contributor, but you know, it's about 2 milligrams per liter is what we see in rainfall and in snowfall, which, you know, it's something, but it's not the main contributor to nitrogen inputs.
Going to take a short break, back in just a moment, live with Chris Jones, former University of Iowa researcher who studies agriculture's effects on water quality. His book from last year received quite a bit of attention, especially here in Iowa. The Swine Republic struggles with the truth about agriculture and water quality. And we'd enjoy having your questions about water quality. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a moment with more of River to River.
Support for IPR comes from Security Abstract Company, providing trusted, comprehensive abstract and title services to the Johnson County real estate market since 1898, located in downtown Iowa City and at securityabstractcompany.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back more with Chris Jones, a former University of Iowa researcher who studies agriculture's effects on water quality. He's the author of The Swine Republic, Struggles with the Truth About Agriculture and Water Quality. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Your questions about water quality, in particular, Chris studies agriculture's effects on water quality. Let's go to our phones. You've really lit up our phones here, Chris. Let's tackle a few of these in quick succession if we can. Mike is with us. A different Mike, but this one from Davenport. Hi.
Hi. My question is, I noticed in the news a few weeks ago they were saying that Iowa's second in the country in colorectal cancer incidence, and at the time they were saying it was all due to binge drinking for college students, and I'm wondering if it isn't related to all the nitrates in our drinking water. I know that Chris Jones has some good insights on that, so I figured I'd let him answer my question.
So, sure, this issue with cancer and Iowa having the second highest rate has been in the news a lot. And, you know, when I was working, I really hesitated to talk about these issues because I'm not an epidemiologist. But You know, we know that high nitrate in drinking water is a risk factor. We know the literature, the scientific literature shows that colorectal cancer is one of the cancers that's associated with this, and we've seen literature from Wisconsin showing on the order of 270 excess deaths or cases of cancer per year in Wisconsin from nitrate. And so I think it's obvious that this is a risk in Iowa.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike. Calling from Davenport, let's go to our next caller. Brett is in Cedar Falls. Hi, Brett.
Yes, my question is, how come, you know, I understand the pollution in the surface water sources are being monitored, but what about the groundwater sources? You know, a lot of cities are dealing with nitrate and ammonia issues across northeast Iowa and many other places. Why aren't we doing anything about that as a state? And at an alarming rate, you know, cities are going to start having to look at putting treatment devices in, that, which they already are doing. I understand the University of Iowa Surface Water Treatment Plant is going through some many large upgrades just because of nitrate pollution, you know, and, you know, the Iowa River, but also our groundwater has been contaminated all over the place yet. We don't discuss that much.
So that's right. Groundwater is contaminated around Iowa. We've had about 7,000 private wells contaminated above the safe drinking water limit of 10 since the year 2000. Northeast Iowa is kind of a hot spot of groundwater contamination because of the unique geology there, the karstic geology and the thinner topsoils, and so the inputs of nitrogen get down into the bedrock aquifers very quickly and very readily. And so, yes, a lot of private wells and community water supplies have been contaminated. You know, we've addressed that in a way with the formation of these rural water systems around Iowa, and so that's a USDA program, and so we have several rural water associations in Iowa that provide water to small towns. Many of those have been contaminated with nitrate, and so why policy at the state level doesn't do anything, I don't know.
Brett, thank you very much for your call from Cedar Falls. Let's move to Don in Davenport. Hi, Don.
Hi.
Welcome.
What a great topic.
What's your question?
My comment is that it seems to me that if we could require these drainage tile systems to all be retrofitted with bioreactors or some similar feature, we could do a great deal to solve this problem.
So the caller is referring to the wood chip bioreactors. That's what we call an edge of field practice that intercepts the tile water and it quenches the nitrate before it gets to the stream. These do work. We know that they do work. It's not a landscape scale solution because we need so many of them, and we will never have the money to pay for all these edge of field practices that we need. And that includes the wood chip bioreactors, constructed wetlands, the saturated buffers. It's just not a landscape scale solution. And I mean, this is my point when people ask me about bioreactors and these other practices. Look, how do we ask the taxpayer to pay for these edge of field practices and then give farmers license to do whatever they want with the nitrogen inputs? It's perverse policy. And so these practices do work, but it's never going to solve the problem.
Let's go to Mary in Fairfield. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Two things. I was told years ago that the owners of the CAFOs could actually use some type of a bioreactor so that they don't pollute the waterway. That was my first question. Does he know anything about that? And also, as a citizen and a small farm owner, what can we do to promote cleaner air, water, and soil in Iowa?
So as far as the bioreactors, again, yes, there are different systems, different practices for livestock systems that, again, intercept the water and then quench the pollutants before they get to the stream. But again, these things are not landscape scale solutions. It doesn't address the cause of the problem. And so I'm not a big fan of these engineered solutions. We need to look at the cropping systems and the animal production systems and produce the crops and animals in ways that don't generate the pollution in the first place. As far as what can the average person do, I get this question a lot. Clearly, the legislature is kind of a non-starter here right now. And so what can you do? And what I tell people is, look, you got to agitate for clean water at the local and county level. And so, you know, the state legislature is not the only governing authority in Iowa. And so look at your county. Who's got authority in the rural areas? It's the county supervisors. Well, guess who oversees these drainage districts and the tile drainage systems? It's the county supervisors. And so when the supervisors are making decisions about the drainage infrastructure, people need to be at those meetings agitating for clean water and asking, how are these systems affecting water quality in my county?
Marion Fairfield, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit more about what you have your eyes on, Chris. For those just joined us, water quality expert Chris Jones looks at, he studies agriculture's effect on water quality. What do you have your eyes on in particular in this legislative session?
Well, we see an effort here to hand over control of the watershed management authorities to the Secretary of Agriculture. These were formed in 2010 to bring the stakeholders together within a watershed to address the problems. And so there's a number of them in Iowa. There's a bill in the legislature that would require the watershed management authorities to only spend money on practices that are approved by the nutrient strategy, and then they essentially just become another way to funnel money into the pockets of farmers. And so I just don't agree with that. The bill also would prevent the WMAs from doing any water monitoring. And so we know, you know, this history of farm practices, conservation, there hasn't been a lot of accountability on how they're improving conditions. Monitoring is the way we do that. And when we restrict monitoring, we also restrict the accountability that's of the public money that's being spent in this way. And so that's one big one. I think this bill introduced to allow confinements to apply manure before DNR has approved their nutrient management plan or their manure management plan is a real travesty. We saw this with Supreme Beef up at Bloody Run Creek. A judge ordered the confinement operation to stop removing manure from their lagoon until they and DNR fixed the nutrient management plan. The bill would allow these facilities to apply manure before DNR approved the manure management plan. And I just think, you know, we dress all these things up as water quality bills. They're not water quality bills. They're water pollution bills. And what they do is they just enable the polluter to further impair the waters of the state.
A few more minutes with water quality expert Chris Jones, formerly of the University of Iowa, retired last year. He is also author of a book from last year. We had him on for that, The Swine Republic, Struggles with the Truth About Agriculture and Water Quality, published in 2023. Roseanne is with us from Marshall County. Roseanne, welcome to the program.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, what's your question?
I was wondering if there's any regulation or I live in a very rural area south of Marshalltown, and that when farmers want to clear more area for their fields, they just push everything that's in the way into the creeks and streams, from trees, bush, debris, whatever's in the way.
So these drainage districts that have been created around Iowa often discharge into a ditch, and we see these constructed ditches. They're straight, and they're often in a trapezoidal configuration. And so, you know, farmers want those ditches cleaned out because the trees and everything else slow up the water flow. Our strategy here is to get water off the landscape as fast as possible. And so No, there's generally not many rules preventing farmers from doing this sort of thing. And, you know, that's our basic problem here in Iowa. It's basically a free-for-all in terms of the environment and how we conduct agriculture on the landscape.
Roseanne, thank you.
Okay.
In recent years, Chris, state officials have sought to help farmers implement the edge-of-field conservation practices. These are practices meant to slow the release of this runoff and underground water flows to remove those nutrients before they reach the streams. How effective have those efforts been in your view?
Well, they can be very effective. If they're targeted correctly and are intercepting a high nitrate source from a tile and the tile is flowing with a lot of water. But as I said in response to the question from the caller, these are not a landscape scale solution. And so they're just little treatment plants in essence. And, you know, the amount of money that we would need to solve the problem in this manner is just enormous. And so a wood chip bioreactor, for example, it intercepts the water from 40 acres. Well, I mean, we have, what, 26 million crop acres across Iowa. Well, what's 26 million divided by 40? I don't know. But, it, you know, these things cost $10,000 or $15,000 a piece. A constructed wetland can cost $500,000 or more. And so I just don't see these as being a solution to the problem. They do make good fodder for public relations for our Department of Agriculture and the ag groups.
Mm-hmm. When we spoke last summer, Chris, we talked about the Iowa legislature voting to defund the system of river and stream water quality sensors that are used at the University of Iowa, where you were formerly employed. Talk a little bit more about that. The importance of these sensors, for one, and the funding status now.
So, yes, the money for the sensor network was diverted over to IDOLS, as I understand it. The sensor network is still operating on sort of a bare bones condition. There's still some sensors in the water. The sensors are important because they illustrate to the public what water quality is in their stream of interest right now. And so you can go and you can see what water quality is in the Iowa River or the Des Moines River or Bloody Run Creek or what have you right now. And I think this is very important for the public to have this accessibility, right? And, you know, that's what a lot of people don't like about it. The data also is pretty instrumental in quantifying the statewide nitrogen load. We know that the nutrient strategy has an objective of 45% reduction. The sensor data, the sensors were capturing a nitrate coming off of about 85% of Iowa. And so this was really a one-of-a-kind system in the world. It's just a real shame that this is not going forward as it is, because it was a real bright spot, in my estimation, on money being spent for the nutrient strategy and the Iowa Nutrient Research Center at Iowa State.
Mm-hmm. The effects of our policy here go far beyond our state borders. Remind us again of how this affects the downstream, the Gulf of Mexico, fishermen, shrimpers in the Gulf.
So the Corn Belt drains to the Mississippi River primarily, also some to the Great Lakes. The nutrients from the Corn Belt get into the Mississippi River. They get down to the Gulf of Mexico, and they catalyze these huge algae blooms off the coast of Louisiana and Mississippi. And when the algae die, they consume oxygen in the water column, and they leave the shore, near shore areas unsuitable for desirable species like shrimp and fish and so forth. And so the commercial and recreational fishery down there suffers. And so I always say, you know, what we're doing here isn't just polluting here, we're polluting at the continental scale, right? And so what we do affects the environmental integrity of the continent, right? And even though we're a small part of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, this will go be our last caller, Joe from Hastings. Have to make it quick, Joe. Sure glad you could join us.
Yes, hi, thanks. Chris, what is your landscape solution? You know And I know that the food system needs to be revolutionized. For instance, do you think we need more farmers on the land? How would you do that?
So the first thing that has to happen is ethanol needs to die. About 60% of our corn is used to produce ethanol. It creates this perversity in terms of land prices. We have this sort of insane land value here of our farmland. Land values have tracked in lockstep with the amount of ethanol produced in this country. We know that ethanol is not a climate change solution. Why are we doing it? The only reason we're doing it is for commerce. And so we need to get rid of ethanol. That would affect land prices. It might cause a lot of the landlords here in Iowa that rent land to farmers to divest themselves of the land. That would enable more young farmers to get in the business. And yes, we do need more farmers on the landscape. When more people are managing our land, that makes implementation of conservation easier.
Okay. Thank you very much for the time. Chris Jones in our studio, former University of Iowa researcher who studies agriculture's effects on water quality. Chris, very quickly, how do people find your Substack?
So the Substack is at riverraccoon, all one word, .substack.com. Or if you just Google Chris Jones, a Substack, you'll go right to it. So.
Chris Jones, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Ben.
Back with more River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Security Abstract Company, providing trusted, comprehensive abstract and title services to the Johnson County real estate market since 1898, located in downtown Iowa City and at securityabstractcompany.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Recently, the U.S. Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm, announced that the Department of Energy is supporting a project led by Iowa State University to build the first microgrid in a rural Iowa community. Now, this proposal would transform the generation and distribution of electricity in Montezuma. It's a town about 1,400 residents east of Des Moines. Joining us now to explain what this means, Chow-Yu Wong, Associate Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Iowa State University. Chow-Yu, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Chow-Yu in our Ames studio, joining us by phone, Kevin Kudart. He's a superintendent at Montezuma Municipal Light and Power. Kevin, welcome to you.
Yes, glad to be here. Thank you.
Chow-Yu, let's start with you because, like me, I imagine most of our listeners are like, what? Microgrid? What is that? To tell us what it is and how they work.
Okay. So microgrid, it's a small-scale power grid. It has a local generation. Usually they are solar power, wind power, battery energy storage. Of course, also has diesel generators. They can use these local generations to supply electricity to the local customers. So that's a microgrid. One unique feature of this microgrid is that it can be disconnected from the large transmission grid and operate by itself.
Okay, so microgrid is smaller. So to be classified as a microgrid, are there a number of residents, people it has to serve? I'm thinking of, you know, when I think of micro things, I think of microbreweries. So it's kind of like the difference between a big brewery and a small brewery. We're generating not beer, but electricity, huh?
Yes. So actually, it's not only about the size. We call it microgrid not only because it's a smaller compared to large transmission, or we call it a macrogrid, right? So that's different. I think the major difference between microgrid and the traditional power system is whether this grid can be operated by itself, can be self-sustainable. Mm. For microgrid, it can be disconnected from the outside. And because it has local generations, so it can be self-sustainable and power the customers within this microgrid just using the local power. So that's the major difference.
Mm-hmm. So this leads us right up to one of its major benefits right here, that should there be something happening, so Montezuma residents, electricity consumers, will be plugged into the macro grid, the larger electricity grid. but they have this as an option. Will they work at the same time? How will that be in the future?
Yes. So you got it correct, Ben. So this microgrid can significantly enhance the resilience to some emergency or extreme events. So for example, in 2020, the derecho actually Montezuma was disconnected from the large transmission grid because of the the extreme events, and they were able to power the local residents just using their diesel generators. So in that sense, actually Montezuma is already a microgrid because it can be disconnected and operated by itself. But remember, all of this was achieved by using diesel generators. So now what we're going to build is a clean energy. It's a renewable microgrid will be powered by solar and battery storage and reduce that operation of diesel generator. So I think this is the difference. This is the advancement we're going to introduce to Montezuma grid.
Yeah, so this is a town of, as I said, about 1,400 residents east of Des Moines. And so we're going to be sort of self-sufficient, have this microgrid that produces power from solar panels, stores it in a battery storage a system. So that's going to be quite an outlay for infrastructure. Talk about, Chow Yu, the challenges there. What has to happen? What will be installed in order to make this microgrid happen?
Yes. So I think the major challenge is to maintain the power, I mean, the generation and the load balance, right? You have to maintain that so that the microgrid can be self-sufficient. So to do this, we're going to install a 2.5 megawatts solar array there, and also a 1.5 megawatts hour battery energy storage system there. If you add them together, actually that's still not able to supply the total peak load at Montezuma. So we still have some diesel generator that will be operating if needed, but that operation will be much reduced compared to the current situation. And we are going to install two EV chargers, and that's level 3 fast charger. So that's very useful to local EV owners. And another thing we are going to do is that we will have the microgrid controller, a smart control, and a monitoring system installed so that Montezuma utility can monitor and control this system remotely. Mm-hmm. So that's what we are going to do.
Mm-hmm. With this proposal, Chow Yu, why was Montezuma selected to partner with as a place for this ISU work?
Okay, so I think that's a good question. Actually, the main reason is that we need a very active and a lively town, and Montezuma is that kind of town. And this, when we are looking for partners, we actually submit several proposals to this opportunity, and this one got selected. I think we like Montezuma for many reasons, because it's a small rural town, but it's very active and has not only residential part, but also the commercial part and the industrial part. And also we have Kevin Kudart here, and Kevin is very passionate about the new technology and the advancement in the renewable energy technologies. So I think that's very, very important. So you need to have a partner that is active and also passionate about this opportunity.
Okay, Kevin has been off in the wings. Let's raise the lights in the auditorium on Kevin, since you introduced him so well there, Chow Yu. Kevin, the superintendent of Montezuma Municipal Light and Power, give us your angle on this. What are your concerns, or what do you want to bring out about this project announced by the Department of Energy?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's that a large university in a small rural community can work together to achieve a project like this.
Mm-hmm. So what does this mean, Kevin, for Montezuma residents going forward? Will they notice any difference in the electricity consumption end of things, or will things, if they go as planned, just be as normal for residents?
Well, everything should be as normal. Obviously, the main objective is to have reliability. And as Jiao, you mentioned earlier, in the event of the derecho, we was disconnected from the main grid. And we, as soon as the winds let up with our diesel generations, when we was able, we had power supplied to the power plant, the city offices, and the fire station within 45 minutes. As the crews cleared everything in town that could be restored, they was restored. And I think we accomplished, that storm hit, I believe, around 11:30 in the morning.
Yep.
And by 2 o'clock that afternoon, we had everybody that could be on, back on, and powered up and going, which included county seat, government offices, manufacturing plant, the doctor's offices, the grocery stores, the gas stations. On the other hand of everything, the feasibility, I don't foresee us dropping rates, but I think it more would be a rate sustainer for a longer period of time where we can hold the rates at a stable without raising them, and which in turn would provide very affordable electricity to our customers.
Mm-hmm. Both you and Chow, you have mentioned the 2020 derecho that caused damage and outages in many parts of the state. Kevin, perhaps then, because we're talking about resilience and how microgrids can be more resilient and reliable, especially in extreme weather, and of course, with climate change, we're expecting more and more extreme weather. So walk us through, let's say there, this project, I understand, will take about 4 years to complete. Let's go a few years down the road. When this project is complete, and we would have some kind of extreme weather knock out the macro grid, Kevin, how would it be different than what Montezuma experienced in 2020 with the diesel power generator backup?
Well, I think the main difference would be we would have more generation. We would, obviously, the solar would be adding to, and the battery storage would be adding to our generation, so to speak, bank capacity. The second major step of that would be we could supply that power and decrease our carbon footprint by not having to use as much diesel power to supply the town. I guess that would be the main contributing difference.
Mm-hmm. Chow, you have anything to add to that point?
Yes, I think Kevin said exactly correct. But in addition to that, I also want to mention it's not only about generation. We're going to, you know, significantly upgrade their two substations with new technologies. So these new technologies, new switchgear and new substations will, of course, be more reliable and resilient to extreme events. So in addition to the additional generator we're going to add.
Mm-hmm. So Kevin, speak to the replacing of the aging substation. So this is bringing those substations into the 21st century. Would that be a way of saying it?
Yes. I mean, obviously, the second step past generation is distribution to get that power to your customers. So a lot of our switchgear is vintage. It's 50s and 1950s, 1960s vintage.
Mm.
And if it does go bad, it's hard to find replacement parts, if you can. The reaction time for both tripping and closing is significantly slower. We're in the midst of a 10-year study to also upgrade the distribution system along with this.
Yep.
So like I said, there's two major factors, generation and distribution. This is step one in the generation part.
And I suppose when you have a new distribution system, you waste less power in that distribution, Kevin.
Yes, you can cut back on your line loss, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to make sure we include the energy workforce needed for this new system. Chow, you talk about training the workforce that must go along with the new system that would, as I said, take about 4 years to complete.
Yes, so I think another advantage or another benefit this project will bring to the state of Iowa is a workforce training part. So we will develop some microgrid training curriculum for community colleges in Iowa, and also for Meskwaki Nation. They're, I think, the only tribe here in Iowa, and also for Iowa State students, of course. And through this workforce training collaboration, we can train students to design and operate microgrids for future projects, in addition to the Montezuma project. And another cool thing we are going to do is that we will create a digital twin of Montezuma microgrid. So what's digital twin? You can think it's a digital copy of this microgrid. So students at Iowa State, at community colleges, at Meskwaki Nation, they can visualize the real-time power generation, solar generation, battery storage operation, EV charger operation, and real-time load electricity consumption. Just visualize them all in real time, and they can play with different scenarios. What if solar is more? What if I have more EV chargers? So they can play with different scenarios to understand the operation of this microgrid.
Chow-Yu, what are the future of microgrids? I don't know how unique this is. This is, as we said, the first microgrid in a rural Iowa community. Do they exist in numbers in urban areas and other parts of the U.S. in great numbers?
We believe this is the very first utility scale microgrid here in the state of Iowa. Across the nation, there are a handful of microgrids, not many. And most of them are designed for very specific locations and purposes. For example, the university campus, the industrial park, and the office buildings. So they were not designed for people's daily life, the residential customers' daily usage. That's not the common design for existing microgrids in other parts of the U.S. But this Montezuma microgrid is different. You know, the Montezuma residents is going to use this microgrid every day, 7 days, 24 hours to 7 days. So this is designed for their daily use.
Chow-Yu, do you hope this will be a model that other communities will follow in Iowa and elsewhere?
Yes, that's exactly what DOE wants us to do, and why DOE likes this project, because they think that this project has a very good replicability. So what we want to show is that through this Montezuma project, we can build a good model, not only technology model, but also financial and economic model, to show to other communities in Iowa and other utilities in Iowa, this microgrid may be a solution for some of your challenges, and it's technically and financially feasible.
I hear the excitement in your voice, Chow-Yu, about this. Kevin, to end our conversation, what's most exciting for you about this project as the superintendent of Montezuma Municipal Light and Power?
I believe the most exciting part is the actual development of the grid and the solar arrays. I'm always excited about adding new stuff.
Well, good luck with this. We'll hopefully check back in, since this is a multi-year project you're setting out on soon. Secretary of Energy announced that the Department of Energy is supporting a project led by Iowa State University to build the first microgrid in a rural Iowa community. I've been speaking with Chow-Yu Wong, Associate Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Iowa State University. Also, Kevin Kudard, the Superintendent at Montezuma Municipal Light and Power. Kevin, Chow-Yu, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Ben.
Yep, thank you, Ben.
Today's program produced by Danny Gear, with help from Sean McClain in Ames. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.